Hey, everybody, it's Nicole Byer here with some hot takes from Wayfair. A cozy corduroy sectional from Wayfair? Yeah, that's a hot take. Go on and add it to your cart and take it. A pink glam nightstand from Wayfair? Scalding hot take. Take it before I do. A mid-century modern cabinet from Wayfair that doubles as a wine bar? Do I have to say it? It's a hot take. Get it at Wayfair.com and enjoy that free shipping, too.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
All right. Welcome back to another episode of Friends from Work. This is a podcast about all things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And it's hosted by me, Kyle Scunawell, and my longtime friend from work. Now standing 6 foot one.
Three.
Two? Three.
Three. Yeah.
Weighing a very unhealthily like 140 pounds or something. Please welcome to this podcast, Robbie Earl. Chicago style. Wow. It's been a really fun summer, man. It's been a really fun summer. I am mixing in some vacations to Michigan that have been really fun. Michigan's the best in the summer. Holy cow, it's the best in the summer. I want you to come up there sometime in the summer. We went to Comic-Con, as you heard us talk about last week. That was really fun. I've loved Superman. I've loved Fantastic Four. I loved Thunderbolts at the end of May. It's just been a really good time. This is an extra special banger for you, though. This is one of the biggest gets we've ever had. And it's kind of, you know, time appropriate just with the Comic-Con thing we were talking about. I don't actually think he was at Comic-Con, but we talked about him a lot while you and I were together.
Yeah. And so he was nominated for an Eisner Award, which we attended the Eisners while we were
did.
There.
And that's where he heard his name come up. But he's a legend in his own right, too.
Yeah, I mean, Chip is one of my favorite comic creators. He's a writer and an artist. He's won awards for both an indie series with Matt Fraction about 10 years ago when they started. That was this breakout hit and hilarious in a way that you would expect a Matt Fraction, Chip Zdarsky comic to be. So, yeah, I mean, we've talked about him a lot on the podcast in the last year because his run on Daredevil really inspired the first season of Daredevil Born Again.
And that's right.
Probably even more so the second season of Daredevil Born Again.
Oh, that we're going to see.
Yeah.
Next spring. Okay. Is he involved in that some way or just inspired? I wonder if they've called him at all or.
I mean, I know that so Kevin Feige is now technically the head of Marvel Studios and Marvel Comics. And
yeah,
so
that's right.
I know that Chip has said that, you know, they now kind of have to get clearance for certain things from studios, I think people worry that Marvel Studios is being too heavy-handed, but I think it's just to kind of make sure that there's some level of synergy. But I don't think that they're like declining certain plot points. But I do think that because of that relationship, Marvel Studios is now aware of what's happening in the comics much more quickly. So I've heard Chip say before that it's like as he's like coming up with a new character like Cole North in his Daredevil run, that's almost immediately getting now written into Daredevil Born Again with, you know, much quicker turnaround than you used to see. So I think that in some ways, like he is consulting always, you know, like he's sort of always kind of speaking into it. But yeah, he has like, he was listed in the credits for Born Again and Fantastic Four as a big influence. He visited the Fantastic Four set with a handful of other writers. And he talked about that a little bit in our interview. So he is like, he's had a big couple of years. And we're talking right now because he's actually kicking off a new Captain America run that has started really strong with kind of a crazy big swing of a first issue. So he's done everything. A lot of people know him for Spider-Man, and it would be fun to talk to him more about that down the line once we get to Brand New Day. But yeah, he is getting much, much more, he's being referenced much more frequently within the MCU, which I think speaks to how well his work translates across multiple mediums.
So I think you're going to enjoy this conversation. If you want more on the comics front, hint, hint, check out Friends From Work Plus, because Robbie and I are actually going to be going through some comics over there. We'll explain that more in the future. But also, if you want a more in-depth look at other films, like comic book adjacent or sci-fi films like Superman, check out Friends From Work Plus, because we have a screensaver series going on over there where we talk about all kinds of other movies. And then if you want, obviously, more Marvel content, more discussion on Fantastic Four, on Thunderbolts, on Dr. Doom, on where we're going, check out Friends From Work Plus. It's $8 a month. You can subscribe on Patreon, Apple, or Spotify, and it directly supports this podcast. It's probably the biggest driver in keeping Robbie and I able to do this, like keeping us going. And so check out Friends From Work Plus now. It helps support us. In the meantime, enjoy this incredible discussion that Robbie Earl, our very own Robbie Earl, had with Chip Zdarsky. Without further ado, please welcome Chip.
All right. Today we are joined by the writer and artist behind comics like Daredevil, Batman, Avengers Twilight, Spider-Man Life Story, Public Domain, Afterlift, the multiple Eisner Award-winning writer and artist, Chip Zdarsky. Chip, welcome to Friends From Work.
Thanks. It's always weird when somebody just starts listing my credentials. I'm like, what? Did I do all that? That's weird. Yeah. That's weird. I've been doing this too long.
I do want to start there, though. It's interesting looking at your body of work. You kind of started out doing humor journalism. I first became aware of you with Sex Criminals, which you drew alongside Matt Fraction. You know, I knew you as like the funny guy for the longest time. You had Howard the Duck. After that, you had other books that were also kind of in that lane, like Jughead, I think, with Ryan North.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I remember some commentary out about, like, you know, can like the Howard the Duck guy write a good Daredevil? You know, what is this going to be? And then, you know, obviously you had massive success with Daredevil. You went on and did Batman, and even before that, Fantastic Four. My point is, you've covered so many genres and approaches to the medium now that it's really hard to pigeonhole you or to kind of paint you as a, like, this kind of comics guy. And I'm always curious with creators how they would define their body of work, but especially with you, because you've like, you know, you've written, you've drawn, you've done both. Like, if I were to tell someone, you know, you've got to check out a Chip Zdarsky comic, here's one to start with, what do you think that comic should be?
It doesn't exist. I mean, yeah. So I'm not very good at having a career. It looks like I am, because I'm active. But when you think about writers, for the most part, they kind of pick a lane and they stick to it, because that's the way you build a brand and you build a fan base. You know, you think of Stephen King, you know, he deviates once in a while, but he's the horror guy.
Right.
You know, John Irving, you're getting a legal thriller. Daniel Steele, you're getting romance. Like, and there's a reason for that, right? Like, you get better at that thing, and your readers kind of know what to expect. So it's always weird when someone says they're a fan of my work, because I can't picture who would be a fan of my work, because as a whole, it doesn't make any sense to me. Like, there's Jughead, right, and there's Daredevil. There's New Burn, and then there's like the White Trees, and then there's like Howard the Duck. Like, there's just, I make stories the same way literally everyone else consumes stories. Like, I'm assuming you're not a guy who just watches comedies, or a guy who just watches dramas or cowboy stuff. Like we consume a variety of stuff. And so I always want to make a variety stuff. So it's weird for me to try and distill down, like, oh, what would a Chip Zdarsky comic be? Like, I know the ones that are kind of my favorites, but they're just not representative of everything. And it's a weird position to be in, because, like, if somebody hires me, they don't really know what they're going to get. Because the Daredevil is actually a great example, because when they offered it to me, they offered it to me because they knew I wanted it. And and so I took the gig. And I remember going to a Marvel Summit, which is like this big meeting of all Marvel writers and editors, where we were all kind of talking through our books, and it was time for me to kind of pitch my book in the room. And everyone was just kind of chuckling beforehand because they thought it was going to be a funny book. They kind of thought I was going to go lighter the way kind of Mark Waid started his run.
Right.
And Mark was in the room too, and he probably thought that as well. And then I told them what I was going to do in the first five issues, and they were like, oh, okay, all right. This is not that.
Right.
So, yeah. So that's a long way of saying I don't know.
No, that is... Well, I'm curious, how did Marvel become aware... I mean, obviously you were writing other things, but mm-hmm. what does that process look like, them becoming aware that you were interested or willing to take on this book? Like, how long before Charles wrapped his run was that conversation starting to happen?
It was the kind of thing where I was under contract with Marvel at that point. Like, Howard the Duck did well and Spider-Man was doing well. And when the editor-in-chief changed over from Axel Alonso to CB Cebulski, CB, mm-hmm. one of his first things he did was he sent an email to everyone that was under contract. At least I assume he did. Basically asking them what their top three titles were. So he knew what to think of when a title came free. Like, okay, so-and-so said they were interested, so maybe we'll put them in the mix. I think anyone that doesn't put Daredevil in that list right. of their top three is insane, because I was having this conversation this morning with a writer who was reading some of my Daredevil stuff, and she was saying she really loved it and was impressed with the kind of the big swings. And I'm just like, well, yeah, Daredevil's the title you can get to do that. Like, I don't know why any writer wouldn't want to work on that book, because you're kind of left alone on that title to a degree. So anyways, Daredevil was in that list. I gave him three titles and Daredevil was one of them. And then so, yeah, I think when they were going to wrap Charles up on the book, they're like, okay, we have some time. Let's reach out and see if Chip's interested. And I was like, all right, let me get to work and see if I have something that's worth the title. So I didn't say yes right away, but I did go and like reread a lot of stuff and kind of figure out what story I wanted to tell.
And you had read, because I know you're a big fan of Anna Sinti and John Romita Jr. stuff.
Yeah.
Your Mangasplaining episode on Born Again. Which I've been listening to Mangasplaining for a while, because you were sort of that was my inroad into manga as well. Oh, wow. So it was kind of nice to have that to be the placeholder for me.
Yeah, you're learning along with me. It's nice.
Yeah. Which I should say for people that are listening that are not aware, Chip co-hosts a podcast where more manga literate folks have kind of walked you through manga. But this was sort of the, as far as I know, the only like inverse episode. Yes.
Yeah, yeah, because we'd bring it up a fair amount. I would. I know my co-host David would as well. As one of the books that we see as being like the best superhero comics that DC or Marvel has produced, I think Born Again is a really amazing tight story. So I was just kind of mostly as like almost like a joke that one episode of Mangasplaining, we were North American corporate comics splaining.
Yeah.
And we chose that.
I mean, it was a fascinating episode for a lot of reasons. But you know, it made clear to me that you had long been a fan of that book. And so when you're rereading for a run, and we can talk about this, you know, in a lot of different contexts, but since we're talking Daredevil, how do you know what to go back and reread? I mean, are you going back and reading like Wally Wood stuff? Are you sticking more to the post Miller stuff? Are you reading Bendis? How do you kind of know what you want to pull from?
It's kind of like, I kind of knew the tone that I wanted, and that tone was pretty close to the Bendis run. So I definitely did a reread of that. And then Brubaker. Charles's run I was currently reading, so I didn't have to go back and reread that. And Nocentes is kind of burned into my brain. So there are a few issues I reread, but I think that's about it. And Wade, there are a couple of issues I reread, of the Wade run. But again, that felt fresh enough that I didn't need to reread it. Yeah, usually for a project like that where there's like so many books or issues, you do mm-hmm. have to kind of pick and choose. When I did Spider-Man Life Story, I reread all of Amazing Spider-Man just because it was all about the continuity. So,
oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I set myself that little dumb challenge. Mostly, it was like kind of an OCD thing, I guess. Like, I just didn't want to miss anything. I didn't want to realize like there's this little bit in the history that I'm like, oh, that would have been fun to put in here.
Yeah.
So I'll probably never do that again because I was like, I was like many days sitting in a Starbucks rereading all of Amazing Spider-Man, and it gets a little rough in the 90s. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there are some swings in there, you know, the whole issue with continuity, especially the way that Marvel sees it, like you are dealing with, you know, decades of things that have happened, and there is this, it's something that I feel like a lot of readers don't want to admit or don't want to think about, but it's like you are having to kind of pick and choose which elements. The original Amazing Spider-Man continuity, in a sense, kind of ended when Ditko left the book.
Yeah. Yeah. I figured there was a writer who said something like every issue is its own continuity. Like you just kind of have to think of it that way. Like you can pull pieces from elsewhere, but like it's a different writer, it's a different artist. Like the feeling is different. Like you kind of have to pick and choose basically continuity for your titles.
Yeah. Which it does make sense. It makes sense also why Daredevil is such a great book to be able to make a big statement on. I am curious though, given that with Daredevil, I would say of the writers that I can think of, you probably made Daredevil as mainstream, you know, within the Marvel continuity as anyone. You know, like Devil's Reign is the first. Is that the first straight up Daredevil cross? I guess Shadowland was the Daredevil.
Shadowland would have been that as well. I mean, that was kind of, you know, this might sound weird to say, but that was an accident of success because the book was doing well enough. And when I was kind of pitching that stage of the Daredevil story, like the VPs at Marvel and the editor-in-chief were just like, oh, wait a second, that sounds bigger than what you're describing. Like, like we should make that an event. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I didn't really consider it as an event. Like, and once it became an event, I had to kind of make it a bit bigger to kind of qualify more. But originally, it was just kind of a smaller story that was just going to take place within the pages of Daredevil. But hey, you know, I mean, it worked for Marvel and, you know, gave them the event they needed and got more eyes on our book. So there's no regrets there. But yeah, it was weird because I was telling a very Daredevil-centric story. You know, I think I had him not in costume for like 12 issues or something ludicrous like that. Like, it's not something you can do in any Marvel book. And then within like 10 to 20 more issues, it was a giant Marvel event. but it kind of worked with what I initially pitched was that my run, I wanted to start with a small thing and then like kind of like the pebble rolling down the hill of snow, kind of gathering more snow as it goes, to the point where, you know, he's riding dragons and he's going into hell to save like a president and his best friend, like just ludicrous stuff. When you look at issue one and how that started. So having the event in there actually ended up kind of making sense.
Yeah. Well, and you know, you did start in that opening arc. You have Spider-Man, you have the Punisher, I think by issue 9, you have Reed Richards. I really love the way that you used these other characters as kind of like different perspectives on who Matt is. And, you know, some of them don't, I guess all of them at this point, because of what Charles did, don't know that he's Daredevil. Yeah. So like those conversations have that added layer.
Yeah.
But again, that's not always something that you get in a Daredevil book, like that many like interactions with other corners of the Marvel universe, especially, yeah, I mean, you know, Fantastic Four.
Yeah, when I mean, you know, Daredevil was their lawyer in issue like 13 or something like that. The I felt like part of the fun of doing Daredevil was seeing those other characters through the lens of that title. Like, you know, it's not like he went into the negative zone with Reed Richards. He was playing chess with him.
Right.
which, you know, you could technically do that in Fantastic Four and have these conversations about God. But like the idea of taking that kind of character and plopping them into Daredevil and having a very kind of human street level kind of conversation was fun. Because I remember, like, again, bringing it back to Born Again. That was a cool moment in Born Again when the Avengers show up and the way Frank Miller's writing and Mazzucchelli's drawings kind of describe those characters. Like he hears the hum of Iron Man's repulsors, you know, Captain America, a voice that can command a god. Like it's all very ethereal and big because it's being seen from that kind of street level perspective. So it's always fun to kind of bring those characters in. And like Spider-Man, I mean, I love writing Spider-Man, but also Marco is like the number one Spider-Man fan. And like, I think that was his first thing he asked me, like, is Spider-Man going to be in this? I'm like, as much as I can, pal.
Yeah. Well, and knowing that you were someone that did a lot of humor books and that the Spectacular book, you know, obviously like 310 is one of my favorite single issues ever, which is fair. It's an issue you won the Eisner for writing and drawing. And that one is both hilarious at points and makes me tear up. So I knew that you had range, but in the opening arc, you can imagine that Spider-Man would be there doing the jokey Spider-Man thing. But it's actually one of the kind of grimmer takes on Spider-Man. You know, and again, he shows up later in the run and he's not always that way. It's not like you're doing a one-note thing. But what... was that always a role that you saw him specifically playing there, kind of confronting Matt?
Yeah, I mean, in my initial pitch, I basically described Spider-Man or Peter Parker as kind of the moral center of the Marvel Universe. Like he's the one that kind of is along with the reader and kind of makes the ethical decisions, which is why, you know, in Civil War, in the comic, like he was such a key component of that, like, because where he went, the reader went. Basically, like the reader follows where Spider-Man goes. And so it's funny when I pitched that, when I pitched it in the room, again, with like 40, 50 Marvel staff and freelancers, after that part, there was a lot of pushback because they were like, they thought it went too far with Spider-Man for him to come down that hard. And I just kept telling them like, you need that. Like you need that. Like he's the guy with the responsibility. He's the guy that like would see Daredevil maybe needing to step back and be the one to be like, you're going to step back.
Yeah.
Also just kind of based on their history and like Spider-Man's kind of guilt over things that have happened in his life as well. So I played it up like, cause there were fights in the room about it and you kind of always know, like the worst thing can happen in the room when you're pitching is if everyone agrees with you, because then you don't have a good story. Like for instance, like, oh, that sounds great. And they kind of move on and they don't have any questions or comments. Like that sucks. Cause like you're just going to put out a book that everyone's gonna be like, okay, that's fine. But like in the past, like I've remembered, you know, pitches where people kind of get heated and those are the ones where you're like, oh, this is going to be a good story. And so when they started to fight about it a bit or kind of take me to task on it, I was like, oh, I think this is going to work. And after that meeting, I basically said to them, I'm like, let me write it the way I want to write it. When I get to that part, I'm going to write it the way I want to do it. And then I'll show it to you. And if you want changes, I'll change it. But like, I feel like you're going to like it. And I think just kind of enough time had passed that nobody cared. So by the time I sent them the script for issue 5, it's like, oh yeah, no, the book's already doing well. So they just, it didn't matter as much. That helped a lot.
Is that something that you have to get sign off on from the Spider office, from Nick Lowe or whoever's, I guess Nick Spencer was writing the Amazing Spider-Man book at that time?
It would definitely be Nick Lowe. And he was technically the group editor of the book. Like Daredevil kind of, at that point anyways, it might still kind of falls under his office. I wouldn't get, you know, Nick's very focused on Spider-Man, like all of those titles. So he kind of trusted his editor underneath him, which is Devin Lewis, just to handle the Daredevil book. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Nick, I'm sure had comments on it as well. I wouldn't be able to do it if he didn't sign off on it. For sure. It's still the case. Like I sent in pitches and I get notes back from every editor who kind of touches those parts.
Yeah.
Which makes sense, you know?
Yeah. It's one thing to have, Daredevil and other books since then that move kind of more into the center of the Marvel universe. But I also think it's interesting looking at just 2025, you're having quite the year for synergy, you know, between Marvel Comics and Marvel Studios, which I know is not something that you planned or anything, but it is, you know, you look at the projects that have released this year and you have Captain America, Brave New World, you're writing the Captain America book, you have Daredevil Born Again, and you wrote the run that a lot of that series seems to be pulling from, if not just plot points, even kind of tonally.
Yeah.
And then, you know, most recently, Fantastic Four, which, you know, I know you would say you have not written Fantastic Four. You wrote Marvel 2 and 1.
But,
you know, you were, you've been out there. You were on the blue carpet, talking Fantastic Four. And so I've been curious as a fan of your comic Public Domain, another Eisner Award winner that you write and draw, which deals so much with the kind of complicated relationship between comics and the way that they are adapted and used and experienced by people outside of their original context. What's it been like for you to now kind of be as in the center of that as you've ever been?
Totally fine. I mean, I have a very different relationship with all that stuff than I think most comic creators do. Partly because I was on the sidelines, not really making those kind of comics when I was watching my friends go through it. Like, you know, I'm buddies with Ed Brubaker. So I saw everything happen with the Winter Soldier and Bucky. You know, I'm friends with like Matt and Kelly Sue and their stuff's been adapted. Kieran and Jamie, their stuff's been adapted. Like, and you know, and obviously, you know, creators before them, I've watched a bunch of people in the comic industry kind of have their stuff adapted and maybe feel slighted or take issue with the compensation on it. I'm definitely speaking from a privileged place because my first big comic was Sex Criminals and I own that with Matt. Mm-hmm. And so we reap the rewards of that. And I know exactly what creator owned can do. And I also know exactly what corporate comics work for hire can do. And so I've never been under any illusion, you know, that I'm getting anything beyond the page rate. And we live in the time where this stuff has gotten as big as it's ever going to get. Like, you know, some might suspect, you know, maybe this Marvel superhero stuff is kind of like plateaued.
Right.
But you know, you had no idea like 20 years ago that like the Winter Soldier was going to show up in something or John Walker Cap was going to show up in something. Like they've pulled off so many characters from deep, deep, deep in the bench, that you just would never have expected in a million years. You know, if you created Batman or whatever, like, sure. Like,
right.
That's one thing. But like all these other characters and the complicated storylines and the hundreds of people that have worked on these storylines are now all in the movies and the streaming shows. And, you know, maybe I'm blind to the avenues that these could go next, but I feel like we've seen the peak of it.
Yeah.
And so I know exactly how I'm compensated for Marvel, how the stuff could end up being exploited or used, and I'm okay with it. Like I've entirely made peace with it. Like it's fine for me, like at the position I'm at. And there's a thing in, you know, in Public Domain, like I definitely made sure that, that main character, Sid Dallas, he was okay with it as well.
Yeah.
Like he was kind of in retirement and, you know, he had a good house and he was fine and he got joy from the fact that people love this stuff. And it was his kids and his wife who were just kind of like, his kids were kind of more upset about, or his one son more upset about, like, the money part of it. Like, they're making all this money off you. And the wife was a little upset about, like, that you never fought for this creation, that you just kind of let it go. And everyone's got good points in that. And so that comic is about the fact that it's complicated and that feelings are complicated and corporations don't care about you. And, you know, and that's, I think that's the reality of the situation. So it's a long answer to say that, like, I'm fine.
Yeah.
Like, I'm fine. But that's not to excuse the behavior of the companies either. Like, again, you know, I've had people that I know kind of go through it, and people I don't know that you kind of, you know, you're contributing to their GoFundMe. So there's, like, there's a real problem, not just within the comics industry, but just within contract work itself. That's the funny thing is, like, I remember saying a few years ago, wow, it seemed like Marvel was, like, a real leader in gig economy contract work, where nobody actually has a job at the company. They, you know, they do gigs for the company, you know, 3-month contracts, things like that. No one has a career at any company anymore. It always seems very kind of short term. And Marvel's really ahead of the ball on that, because they've been doing that since they started in the 60s, right?
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing to see. And also, you know, there's also just the system we all live in. Like, if you see a GoFundMe for a comic creator, more than likely there's a medical emergency, and the system does not help.
Yeah.
You know, I'm also grateful to be Canadian for that.
I know, I was going to say that's I guess also
there's less GoFundMes for Canadian creators.
Yeah,
it's actually hard for me to think of one right now. I don't know if there are any. I'm sure there are, but, like, you know,
that is telling.
Yeah.
Are you the first Canadian to write Captain America?
I am. There have only been 2 other non-Americans, and they only wrote, like, 4 issues each, I think. Like, Dave Gibbons was one. Was it James Robinson the other? I forget who the second one was, but it was, like, just, like, basically fill-ins. So, yeah, it's it's weird.
Well, and, yeah, you know, in the year 2025 again. I think in any other year, I don't think anybody would ever even consider Canada and the US to be in any kind of confrontational relationship.
Yeah.
But, you know, you get picked to write Captain America, and then now, you know, you have the White House robot romance book coming out, which also involves a war between Canada and the US.
Sure so does.
It seems to me that you're trying to start something.
Clearly. Yeah. White House robot romance. It was pre-election when I was working on that, and US election, I should clarify. And I don't know. I was like, well, what kind of disastrous thing could I kind of tap into? And I was just like, oh, this is the thing that's going to happen. Like, I think as Canadians, we always kind of have in the back of our heads the idea of manifest destiny and climate change and resources dwindling and ice caps melting, and, like, all of a sudden the North becomes a lot more habitable and the South becomes uninhabitable. it's been a long thing between me and my friends and my family and everyone I know in Canada where we're just like, yeah, it's going to happen one day. So it made sense to put him into that story, but I didn't realize how quickly that was going to be a thing in the real world.
You kind of have a knack for that, though, because I think Avengers Twilight was kind of similar, right?
I mean, we'd been working on it for a few years, and that was because, you know, the artist, Daniel, slow. Like, you know, he's painting them, right? Like, he's digitally painting each issue. And I think he was working on the issue where Nazis stormed the Capitol as January 6th was happening.
Oh, so
I remember
crazy.
Watching that on TV from, you know, my comfortable home in Canada, being like, oh my God, this is wild. I can't believe this is happening. And then the second thought was like, oh, like, I wrote a comic about this. So I mean, immediately, like, you know, I'm talking to my editor at Marvel, like, mm-hmm. and I basically said to him, like, I can't change it. Like this is where that has to happen.
Yeah.
Like, because we've already got the White House in use for this other thing, and like the Capitol kind of makes more sense as like the symbol. And he was like, you're right. You know, we'll maybe tweak some dialogue to make sure it isn't, you know, too close to what's happening. But we'll publish it as you wrote it, which, you know, to Marvel's credit, it was pretty cool of them to do that. But even still, I'm just like, as soon as it comes out, people are going to be like, what the heck? Like, oh, yeah, what are you going to do?
Lowe's knows you've got a job to do, and we help get it done. With the MyLowe's Pro Rewards program, eligible members save more with volume discounts on qualifying orders through a quote of $2,000 or more. Join for free today. Lowe's, we help you save. Offer can't be combined with any other discount, contract, and or special pricing. Exclusions, more terms, and restrictions apply. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
You were talking about writing like sort of whatever, you know, like whenever I'm watching something or reading something and I'm in the mood for a comedy or a drama or a horror movie or whatever, there's normally like, you know, I can kind of in that moment say, I'm going to go watch this thing. But, you know, you might be already signed up to write a certain thing or like, you know, you've been doing it for a long time. What, like, have you found that books like Public Domain that are books that you own, do those become ways for you to kind of write what you want to write, not content wise, but kind of like tonally, genre wise? Like, is that where you kind of get to scratch the itch?
Yeah, though, I mean,
more directly.
Though, honestly, you could pitch horror, romance, or westerns, or whatever to Marvel and DC, and they'd probably greenlight it because it'll be a different take on their kind of their characters. So there's not a lot of limitations within those companies, except for, you know, maybe kind of more mature fare. But even that, like, I don't know, we've all seen Batman's penis by now. I mean, right? Am I right?
That's what, yeah. Why else are we reading it?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, with a creator owned, it's, you know, there's ultimate freedom there, in tone and in content. Which can be a little daunting as well. Like there's a nice safety net with the superhero stuff in that, you know, those characters, you know, that world, mm-hmm. you know, you can add to it. You can create things that belong in that world, but like with a creator owned book, you got to create a whole world. You got to create characters and you have to kind of quickly make it so the reader empathizes with them. You can empathize with Spider-Man or Aunt May or Reed Richards or whoever, because all the creators before you have kind of done the work.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
No, that's a good point. And then I guess it also gives you something to subvert if you want to do that without having to lay groundwork.
Yeah, exactly. If you subvert a character that you created, like you're just creating a character and there's no, and nobody cares because like, oh, that character is a dick now? They've like, okay. But if all of a sudden you made like Aunt May a dick, it's like, oh, okay, that's subverting a character. Mm-hmm. My example has always been, I'm sure people are sick of this, but like if I write Spider-Man and I have Aunt May get hit by a bus in my first issue, like that's gonna cause a reaction. Like people are gonna feel something for that, because, you know, they've been reading the adventures of Aunt May for a long time. If I'm writing creator-owned comic and I have just an old lady get hit by a bus in issue one, who cares? Like, you've got to do the work. You've got to build her up to a level that, you know, they'll react as if it's an Aunt May. And and that's the tricky part. That's where a lot of kind of creator-owned books kind of fall down, because some creators just aren't used to doing that.
Yeah. The book that you're currently writing, Captain America, one of the longest standing characters in Marvel's history. You know, I would say there's less kind of convoluted mythology than with a character like Spider-Man.
Yeah,
but I would say, you know, it's Captain America. There are certain things that I think people assume Captain America will be or has been. And so I think that on one level, I would imagine that gives you a lot to work with when you're looking at a character like that, and also maybe gives you a lot to consider in terms of what you need to keep intact and what makes him Captain America and kind of how much you can strip away.
Yeah. No, he's more challenging to write in a lot of ways than, say, Daredevil or Spider-Man, because there's less conflict in him, because he kind of knows what's right. And he's like, you know, he's a tragic character, and he's not a joker. He's not, you know, he's not Kraken wise.
Right.
You know, I hesitate to say the word boring, because he's not boring, but he's got that kind of old fashioned kind of feel to him, which is, I think, why, you know, his supporting cast has always been kind of very valuable over the years, because you have more characters to bounce off of him. Yeah, and it's definitely not as convoluted as Spider-Man. And that's, I think, just mostly because of the amount of stories that Spider-Man has had written over the years. Like, cause there's not just Amazing Spider-Man, there's like many titles, and Captain America's always just kind of been a title. And sometimes things happen outside that title, but you know, Captain America stops being Captain America, he becomes Captain America again. He stops being Captain America, he becomes Captain America again. Like, there are kind of like repeating themes within the title that I'm definitely trying to avoid. Yeah, it's challenging because he represents America. And you know, the world looks at America differently depending on which generation is looking at it, during what time period.
Yeah.
And everyone kind of like puts their own set of values onto the character that they think is right and correct, because Captain America is right and correct. So
yeah.
So that makes it challenging as well. Like, I'm not going to have him just be like, become communist or something like that, or have a major deviation from, you know, what people expect from the character, even though that might be a pretty good story.
It is such a unique character in that way, because I, you know, it's like you kind of have the inspiring figures at the heart of these like big two universes. And Superman, like, yes, there's like the American way side of it. But I think that Superman is not really, you can write a Superman story where he's not American. But yeah, Captain America is.
He's literally wearing a flag.
Yeah. And which was so much less complicated. It's still complicated, but less complicated when his primary thing is punching Nazis.
Yeah. And one of the fascinating things, and it's kind of what I've been touching upon in this run, is the shifting timeline of it all. Like, there's a difference between that patriotic hero coming out of the ice 15 years later, which is, you know, when he originally appeared after World War II, versus like 30, 40, 50, 60 years. Like, every time, like, it's,
yeah,
he becomes, yeah, it becomes more of a science fiction kind of tale. The kind of the longer this goes on, like, you know, it used to be he woke up and like a few things were changed. Oh, what a different world. And now it's like, I think in issue two, I have him like remark on satellites. He's like, satellites, you've got like things floating above Earth looking at us. Like, that's wild.
Yeah.
You know, like,
because when he shows up in Avengers 4, it was still pre space race, even, or at least like, you know, pre moon landing. So,
Or even like, you know, I'm, you know, obviously my big kind of swing was that, you know, Cap comes out of the ice after the Twin Towers fell.
Yeah.
But like, Cap never knew the Twin Towers. There was no point where the Twin Towers existed during his lifetime, because they went up in what, the 60s? Like, there's stuff like that. You know, in issue one, you know, they try to send him to the United Nations building. He's like, what is that? Where is that? Like, how do you not know what that is? There are so many things, the further time kind of progresses, that Captain America will have limited knowledge of coming out of the ice. And it really does kind of change it into a bit of a sci-fi story. He woke up in the future, not just like a few years after.
Well, I find that so interesting. Like what you were talking about earlier with continuity, because I mean, that is the whole sliding timeline at Marvel, like whether it's Nick Fury and you kind of have his life extended, or whether you sort of change Tony Stark from being in Vietnam to being in the Middle East, like when these things happen. But I think what you're doing is so direct in how you're taking a character that, like, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't change anything about who Steve is, but I think you're now dating it in a way. And I think that that's, it makes it feel much more visceral. I mean, especially for me, which I'm getting older, so it feels very current to me to talk about 9/11. But talking about these pitch meetings and when you kind of get pushback, was that element of it specifically, not just, not the Two Towers piece, but just putting it in that era and really sort of defining it as this like early 2000s moment, was that something that was seen as a big swing within Marvel?
In the room, everyone loved the fact that I was opening with that time period. Because it hasn't been explored that much. Like Mark Waid did a mini series years ago called Man Out of Time that kind of talked about Cap coming out of the ice. But like my idea of like him going back and being a soldier, like even like the president of Marvel's like, oh, I like that. Like that's fun. Cause we, they do tend to get caught up in like in back to continuity. They want like the freshest, newest kind of in the moment thing. Because kind of retro or whatever, looking back stories don't necessarily do that well. But this felt fresh enough and also affected my storylines afterwards that they're supportive of it. The 9/11 of it all and Cap coming out of the ice afterwards, that had pushback. It was one of those things where I think my editor initially said, there's no way. There's no way. But I think she was kind of looking at the fact that like Marvel publishes in New York, and most of the people that work there above her were working at Marvel in New York during 9/11. And they put out that comic, that Amazing Spider-Man 36, about 9/11. And they're, you know, they were affected by it. So for her, she just thought that would be a no go. And my counter argument was, what do you do in 10 years? What do you do in 20 years? Like at some point you're going to have to do this, because it doesn't make any sense now. It's going to make even less sense, you know, if you keep publishing 25 years from now.
Yeah.
So, if you're going to do it, have the story to do it. And this was the story, like I had the story. And so, she, you know, to her credit, she fought for it. She brought it to the people above her, and like, there were some people like, oh, I don't know. But like ultimately once we hit the top, it was like, oh yeah, no, that makes sense. And also it was like, I think they consulted studios as well, which is really funny because in the MCU, he definitely came after 9/11. So if anything, we were lining it up with 9/11 or with the MCU. So, took a bit of fighting, and then they realized that makes a lot of sense. And I think once they saw my story, they're like, okay, introduces a new character, a new element, a new kind of wrinkle to Cap's kind of history. And you kind of have to do it. Like, you know, there are comics about Cap, like talking about Vietnam,
and
it happened in the comic, but the sliding timeline makes it so that conversation couldn't actually happen. Like it just doesn't make any sense. It's why, you know, that timeline exists.
Well, and it does make it more interesting because you explored in Spider-Man Life Story so well, how someone like Steve Rogers would have responded to Vietnam. For him to come back in an era where that is now already baked in, like, you know, everybody is understanding, like we've talked about this some on the podcast when we talk about the Marvel movies and Steve Rogers' role there as compared to like Sam Wilson, who is someone who's been in the military through these conflicts and, you know, was aware of all of the kind of complicated history, versus Steve, who went out whenever it was like the kind of zenith of like right and wrong and good and evil and how different their perspectives on military service would be. And I think that dropping Steve in like that after that does give you more of that kind of contrast. Whereas, yeah, if he goes through all of the 20th century, I think it kind of, it makes it a little bit harder to sell that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you kind of, you need him to be a little bit naive about the world, for the character to really work. Not a lot, obviously, you know, he's a smart guy, but you know, he believes in the best of people, and that includes countries. Mm-hmm. And he has to be disappointed by that every once in a while.
At what point did you realize that Dr. Doom was going to be the right villain for this opening arc?
Yeah, good question. The I forget how it kind of landed on Doom. Well, I think, I mean, Doom's in the air, obviously, because Marvel is doing their event, One World Under Doom. And I think, weirdly, I kind of came up with my second arc in my head first, and then realized that a story set in the past would help set it up better. And Doom made a lot of sense for it. But once I kind of like casually thought about Doom and then dug into it, I was like, oh no, like this is perfect. Like, you know, Cap went to sleep when there was like a dictator running rampant, ignoring, you know, borders. And Doom is that. Like Doom was, you know, punching the FF in America. Like he wasn't getting a work visa to go do that, you know. Like he was a menace, right? He was a European menace that America had their eyes on. And so it just kind of made sense that, you know, of course, you know, democracy loving Captain America would be against Doom, especially at that time. And being able to kind of figure out like, oh, okay, like would America have a response to this guy? You know, not just outside of the FF, because, you know, all those early Marvel comics, it's all about heroes and villains just kind of trading jabs.
Right.
But, hijinks. You know, besides the Hulk and Ross and the Hulk, like the military is not getting involved in that. Weirdly, you know, there aren't a lot of political discussions about these things. Because they were, you know, they're kids' comics, so of course they're not going to do that.
Right.
But our readership's a little bit older now and more savvy, so you kind of want to dig into how the real people would actually handle these situations.
Yeah, well, and Doom is also an interesting character to do that with, because kind of as you have Reed point out in that first issue, like he's not quite Hitler.
No.
You know, like you wrote Doom a good bit in your Marvel 2-in-1 here, where he was, I think, in kind of the infamous Iron Man era, which, you know, really does showcase that he is, you know, that was him being, trying to be the hero. But even, you know, like the way that Hickman wrote Doom, like all through his run, it's like he's the villain, but he's also kind of right a lot of the time.
Yeah, it's the best way to write a villain, right? If you just write them as like just undeniably evil, like, okay, that's a story, I guess. But like, what if the reader says like, he's got a point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is very, I mean, it is different from like the Red Skull, even as like a Captain America villain. Cause I don't feel like, I have not read very many Red Skull stories where I feel that I'm empathizing with him.
No, because he's so opposite Captain America. Like Captain America is like the purest of the heroes, you know, he's just like, his heart is made of gold and he always does what's right, which means Red Skull is the opposite. Whereas Reed is like, you know, a hero and super smart, but sometimes he makes the wrong call, right? Like sometimes, you know, he's thinking big picture and he ignores the little people or the details or the people in his life. So, you know, to have Doom as his opposite makes a lot of sense. Even Red Skull. I mean, Red Skull clearly is, you know, a character who's racist and evil. But even still, Marvel's not going to play that up.
Right.
like even that's too much for Marvel and for us as readers and writers. Because you'd have to end with every Red Skull story with him dying and never coming back.
Yeah. that book, though, I've thought about a lot as I've started the Captain America run, which we're, as we're recording this, I guess we're, what, a week away from issue 2 releasing, roughly?
I think so, yeah.
I have, which is, this is not always the case. I've reread that first issue several times because all of you are doing so many interesting things. Like the stuff that you're doing with Valerio is like some of my favorite work. Like, I mean, you know, y'all work together on the Fantastic Four stuff as well. Mm-hmm. And all the work on Gods, I really loved.
Yeah.
But there's something here that feels really, like, really focused. And I don't know if it's because it's not a team book or because there's not as much that has to, you know, maybe it's a little bit grounded.
I think that's partly it. Like, I think it was a huge relief to him to not be put on another event team book where you have to design a million things and then draw a million characters. Like, the problem is he's just so good at it that Marvel kept putting him on those because they knew it would come out on time. Like, oh, you need someone on Avengers? It's Valerio, right? Like, it's that kind of thing.
Right.
So that I think that helped a lot. But also, I fought for Frank Martin Jr. on colors, who inherently grounds things. He can make things, like, wild and cool, obviously, but, like, his palette tends to kind of hue more towards kind of grounded, realistic stuff.
Yeah.
Which is what I'm always usually looking for on Marvel books. Unless I was doing like a big cosmic thing, then you get like, mm-hmm. you know, the kind of the standard kind of Marvel poppy, bright, shiny kind of colorists.
Yeah.
But yeah, I tend to lean towards Frank Martin and Matt Wilson, Tamara Bond villain, like people that can mm-hmm. really kind of evoke a mood with their work. And so, and Frank's amazing. Like, Frank's,
man,
he's unbelievable.
Yeah. Frank's stuff on this book. I was talking to Nick Jagoda about this at in San Diego a couple days ago. And yeah, I mean, the stuff that Frank is adding to Absolute Batman, like how much of an impact the colors can have there.
Yeah.
Specifically in grounding, like it grounds it, but Frank also adds this, there's like an atmosphere that he always brings. And I don't know, the style feels so unique to me, but I, as soon as I read this issue, I thought that was such a consequential pick that, like, I don't it sounds like maybe you spoke into that and having Frank come on. I'm sure Valerio was involved in that to some degree too.
Yeah I mean, Valerio's very easygoing. Yeah, I mean, it was a bit of a concern because, like, he's so easygoing, I think we could have given him many colors. He'd be like, okay, yeah, we'll make it work, like that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. He'd worked together with Frank before because Frank also did Marvel 2-in-1 with him.
Okay.
So he knew how he looked with his work. But it's funny, when I got issue 1 done, I sent it to some of my kind of fellow comic writer friends, and a lot of them were like, oh, this is great. Like, Valerio looks like so different here. You know, is he okay with that? I was like, I don't know. Like, at no point did I say to him, are you actually okay with this? Because he'd see the page and be like, great, looks great, awesome, blah, blah, blah. But you can't tell if he's just being nice. But I think he genuinely likes what Frank's doing on the work, because, yeah, it really does give it a different feel. And I feel like if you hire a colorist, you want to feel that colorist on the book. You don't want them just to,
yeah,
again, just kind of do literal colors on things, which is boring.
As someone that that has written and well, been on both sides, you know, having drawn Sex Criminals for a lengthy, I'm trying to, how many issues was Sex Criminals?
31.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, so it was like it was an ongoing thing where you were artist, and then obviously you've written and drawn, certain things. Do you kind of come to that with a different perspective? Like, are you thinking about kind of what you would want in a colorist if you were the one that was drawing that book, or how, or do you think you kind of just put your writer hat on in those situations?
It's weird for me because I would never let anyone color my work. Like, there's a part of me that just thinks it's insane. Like, why would you do that?
Yeah.
Like, for me, that's an entire package kind of deal, because it's so important. And I think a lot of artists just kind of accept whatever's given to them as colorists and just like, they're ruining their work. Like, in a lot of cases, you're just like, oh yeah, no, this would have been a lot better if, like, they'd made actual choices. I'm always looking at it in terms of like combinations, like, mm-hmm. like maybe I wouldn't have picked Frank if it was a different line artist on the book. And a lot of times I kind of wish artists would have kind of a stronger opinion about the colors that they will only work with. Right. That would be great because then I'd be like, oh, okay, good. You know who works for your stuff.
Yeah.
And that can just kind of settle it. Though in some cases, like I think on Daredevil, like Marco had an idea for colorist on that. And I fought back on that because I thought up until that point, Marco, the only thing holding Marco back was the color. Because he never really kind of like broke through as an artist until Daredevil. And I think a lot of that was just because of like, not necessarily poor coloring choices, but like colorists that didn't suit the work.
Yeah.
Because a lot of them were kind of like airbrushy or poppy and like everything was shiny. But Marco's got such grit to the work that you kind of want somebody that can work with that. We had a lot of kind of back and forth on colorists on Daredevil as a result of that. And I think it worked out well, but yeah. Eventually, you know, by the end we had Matt Wilson on the book and Matt followed him to Ultimate Spider-Man. I think they worked super well together. I think they're going to be the team from now on, no matter what book that Marco does.
Okay. That's good. Yeah. I mean, that's another combination. That's so killer. Yeah. I would like to see that with Valerio, and Frank as well, but
the problem is there's only one Frank.
yeah
like there are good colors out there, but like there are so few that really have a recognizable palette where you look at it, if you took all the line art away, you'd be like, oh, okay, that's a Frank, or that's a Tamara, or that's a Matt. Like those are three colorists that I'm just like, I can spot their work a mile away.
That makes sense, and I think is one of those things where it once you see it, it's hard to unsee it.
It's true.
I wanted to at least toss out one question from our patrons, and then one question that I like to ask when we have folks on. That we started the podcast covering primarily Marvel Studios stuff, and have covered all the stuff, you know, since then. That was in 2019, which was a hilarious time to start a Marvel Cinematic Universe podcast. Is there a favorite Marvel Studios project that you have? Is there one that you have enjoyed either because of your role in it or just as a fan especially?
I mean, the cop-out answer is Endgame, mostly because I remember the feeling of seeing it in a theater and being like, and just cackling at what they were getting away with, like just how big it was. Like at one point it was like Spider-Man on a winged horse holding the Infinity Gauntlet, and I'm like,
right.
I'm like, in what world could that happen on screen and also be awesome?
Right.
Like, not cheesy. Like, it was actually just like, it was like a genuinely moving movie with big swings. And it was a huge experience to see that in the theater. That really hit me. I'll also shout out a less loved Marvel movie, which is Iron Man 3. I think Iron Man 3 is actually just a really fun, solid movie. I think Shane Black did a great job on that.
I'm right with you there. Yeah.
The Mandarin twist, Ben Kingsley just killed me. That scene just killed me in the theater when he's revealed. Like, it was a smaller movie. And, you know, I think maybe, you know, like almost all these movies, you know, that last third gets a bit much.
Right.
But it's such a good, fun movie.
Have you seen Kiss Kiss Bang Bang?
Yeah.
It was so funny.
It's, you know, Shane Black, right?
Yeah. I mean, I saw that after Iron Man 3. And then I was like, they just made Marvel Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and totally got away with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, they should do more stuff like that. Like, it didn't tie into anything really. Like, it was a kind of a standalone thing, which I also appreciated. It's funny. Like, I took my wife to the Fantastic Four premiere and she knows nothing about these movies. Like, I've tried. And she'll sit there and she'll watch it with me and she'll check her phone and she's like, whatever.
Right.
And at first I invited her to it and I'm like, yeah, it's in LA. It's going to be cool. She's like, no, it's okay. And then she thought about it. She's like, oh, it is LA. Like, it's a big movie premiere. I'm like, well, here, I'll send you the trailer and you can decide on that. And she said to me afterwards, she's like, I watched a trailer and I understand the story. So I will go see it. Like, there was nothing in that trailer that was like, and it's funny, I think Kevin Feige said recently, like, this is a movie you can just go into basically cold. Right. Like, it doesn't tie into anything really. Like, mm-hmm. they build this world, you get to know the characters, there's a storyline, you know?
Yeah.
Which, you know, and you can't say that for every Marvel movie because, you know, they've fallen into the trap that comics have, right? Like,
right.
Continuity and, you know, oh, this character shows up. That's a big moment, is it? I mean, it is if you know who that is, but, you know, does it work in the movie? So, yeah. So she joined me.
Yeah. I was wondering if Fantastic Four would be that for a lot of people. Like, my wife has not gone to see it yet, but I think that she will enjoy it for, I mean, you know, she's watched most of these along with me, but I think as it starts to get a little bit more.
Exactly.
But no, that's that makes sense. I love the Iron Man 3 shout out there. The other question that I had that we had a patron send in, how do you stay creatively inspired when you're working in, you know, and not just with these characters, but like in general, as you're writing, whether it's creator owned stuff or stuff for Marvel or DC, how do you kind of keep yourself like passionate about it? And from kind of going through the motions whenever it's, you know, you're having to keep cranking stuff out month after month.
It's a fun job. Like, you don't really have to do that. You know, I mean, it was more kind of novel in the beginning. Like, the first time I typed the word thwip as a sound effect, I'm just like, oh, this isn't cool. Or first time you write the Batmobile charges down the street, I'm like, that's cool.
Yeah.
So there's less of that because I've done it long enough. But like, telling stories is fun. Getting artwork back is fun. Seeing those final comics is fun. Like, it's I can't picture a world where I'm fully jaded by that. It's a cool medium to work in, and it doesn't require like a million executives and notes and you know, problems with a studio or anything. Like, it's so direct. I was just saying that to a friend I was talking to earlier, who's like a novelist and a novelist who does comics, and you know, I was saying like, yeah, it's the beauty of doing comics is like, you write a comic, like, within a couple of months it's drawn, within a month after that it's on the stands. Like, if you're writing a novel, like, that novel that you just finished isn't coming out for like 2 years probably, because, you know, you have to get all the drafts and then they got put on the schedule, and like, it's you know, it's kind of wild, the speed, the turnaround of comics. I love it.
It's also the thing that I love about comics. It is such an avenue for exploration and experimentation for that reason, because you can have a series that just doesn't work and it's not going to be this massive blot on your reputation, because you can start another series, or you probably maybe have another series happening simultaneously anyway, where it's like, if you're a filmmaker, if you're a novelist, I think it's hard to, like, that's the thing that you're focusing on. And it takes so much money and time. And so I think, and it's so collaborative, like you're talking about getting to work with different folks. Sometimes you're drawing your own stuff. Sometimes you're working with different artists and colorists. And we keep it fresh too.
It's the same for the companies as well. They can take risks on things. Like, they're putting out like 60 issues a month or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there's a lot that they kind of put out, so they can be like, all right, yeah, I'll try Dark Hawk or whatever this month. Like, we can give it a shot or introduce a character or whatever. If it doesn't work, it's fine. You know, it'll make us money back, hopefully, and we just kind of learn from our mistakes. You can take a lot of risks. Like, Marvel and DC, just as like R&D companies for Disney and Warner Brothers or whoever, it's invaluable. Like, they do make profit, so it's not like they're even like a money losing, but even if they were losing money, all you need is one Miles Morales every 10 years and you've justified all of it. You know, it's pretty wild.
And, you know, again, it's like, what I love about Fantastic Four and I think this is starting to happen more, is you actually do see the filmmakers recognize how they're being handed really great stuff to work with. Like you've got in some cases kind of built in storyboards.
Yeah.
And so I think when that happens, it's an even bigger home run.
Well, it was cool. Like I did a Fantastic Four set visit last year, which was awesome. But like the area for the costume department was amazing because they just had like on their bulletin board, they just had like comic panels and stuff pinned up. Like their reference was like directly from the source, you know, and they had like some photos from the 60s, some Time Life kind of photos and stuff. But then they had like, you know, Kirby thing drawings up as well. And you're just like, oh yeah, of course they are. Like it just makes sense. Like these things work for a reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which it is, you know, you start to see Galactus, you see Mysterio in Far From Home or Hela in Ragnarok, and you see like a willingness to actually just make comic book characters look like comic book characters.
Yeah. Yeah. To not be embarrassed by it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it comes through in your books that you enjoy it and that you have a real love for it. I am genuinely, I mean, the reason I reached out right now is I really am so excited for what you're doing with Captain America.
Oh, thanks, man.
I'm so excited for all the things that you are continuing on, the projects like Stillwater that you have being adapted on that side, that's the thing. There's so much to talk about in your world right now that we didn't cover.
Yeah, it's weird.
But given all of that, I appreciate you taking the time to come on the show.
Thanks, man.
Excited to see what comes next.
I appreciate it.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.